I'm going to talk to you about the human body, mind, and matter. And I want to show to you in three levels the evidence of design, primarily thinking of us, but then I'll move into the subject of information. So Ernest Chain once said this, that evolution is a hypothesis based on no evidence and irreconcilable with the facts. You think that's a little bit sort of strident. But remember, he was a fellow of the Royal Society in his day. He won the Nobel Prize for antibiotics, so he was no fool. He said that after the war, and he worked for a long time after the war as a very good leader in his field. So when people say today that evolution is a fact, they're going in the face of many experts from their own institutions who would have said otherwise. Okay, Sir Ernest Chain isn't with us anymore, but there are many others whom we could quote who cast great doubts on the theory of evolution. I'm going to take evolution as meaning the idea that molecules became men. Okay, that's the basic idea that I'm referring to when I use the term evolution. In this talk, I'm not primarily referring to the scriptures. Most of you here are Christians, but I'm not for this talk going to assume that you're a Christian, right? I know full well that from our discussions earlier that most of you are either Christians or you're from a Christian background. But I want to show you that just reasoning from the science, it shows to us that at least we can come to the conclusion that there is a coherent scientific reason for believing in creation, right? I'm not going to be able to prove it 100%, just like I was saying to a lady earlier. People say, oh, evolution is just a theory. It's not even a theory, it's a hypothesis, because you can't even test it. You can't rerun the experiment. But equally well, we have to admit from the other side, I can't rerun the experiment of creation either. But what I can do is show you a coherency in the creation position, which stands up to any unprejudiced examination. And I stress unprejudiced, because today we have prejudice, which is saying, let's bolt down the hatches and stop these weird creation believers, you know, coming in saying some different story. Evolution is a fact. There is no argument. You've heard it all, people saying that. And I want to show you that actually that is not a valid position to take. That even on their own terms, just allowing the evidence to speak for itself, which isn't actually their terms, because their terms is to presuppose evolution. But if they were to allow the evidence just to be put on the table, you could see a very reasoned case for creation, and that's what I'm aiming to do. Scientific experiment, when you actually just let the science speak, indicates that codes and order, which is going to be my last point, come from intelligence. So I'm not using the term evolution for small adaptations which don't involve any change of function. Adaptations do occur, and indeed mutations occur, which usually lead, by the way, to loss of function, not gain of function. Mutations lead to change. Or adaptations, that means the different alleles, different genetic expressions. You get different types of dogs occurring in different parts of the world due to the fact that temperature and other things will change the fur length. And yet they're still dogs. You get different types of eagles. You get golden eagles, you get fish eagles, probably all descended from the same original eagles. I have no problem with that. But that's not what I mean by evolution. I'm reserving the term evolution for the idea that a finch, or even some creature which wasn't a bird, like a reptile, changed into a bird and grew wings. That's what I'm reserving the term evolution for, right? The idea that we're all descended from some common ancestral amoeba, which is the basic view of sincere evolutionists. I debated one recently in America who sincerely believes that we've come all from a common ancestor. that is also believed very sadly by some Christians. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you evidence for macro design in nature. Then I'm going to look at intricate mechanisms. We're going to look at the ear, the mammalian ear, and then I'm going to consider information and mind. So macro design. For this, I'm going to talk about something very specifically human, which is the hip, the knee, and the foot, and to show to you that these show marvelous evidence of design. I'm going to involve you at one point, so you need to stay awake. The posture of an ape and the posture of a man, supposedly they're meant to come from a common ancestor, that there was an original, some sort of ape-like creature or ape-man-like creature, and apes came one way and men came the other. Well, if that were the case, there ought to be some sort of commonality in the way that we are made, but there really is not. And that's what I want to show you, that there are so many major differences which are indicating very exquisite design. And I'm going to major more on humans than the design of apes, who are perfectly well made for their own environment, which is mainly living in areas where they've got trees and other things to climb on, as we're going to see. That's going to be very relevant when we look at the feet. Just a little point in passing, the posture of an ape, as you can see on the left, tends to be sort of with knees half bent and a leaning over posture. The spine is not made in an S-shaped for vertical posture, and the center of gravity runs in a very different line to the center of gravity line of a human being. Interestingly, the center of gravity for a human being comes up right through the inner ear, which we're going to consider a little bit later. But of course, it goes through the hip, and it goes just in front of the knee, and then down to our feet. We are designed, I'm going to suggest, for an upright posture, whereas the center of gravity is very different for an ape or any monkey-like creature. Let's just consider the major structure of a chimp or an orangutan or an ape, any creature in that simian kind. It's very different to a human being. Let's just home in, though, on the hip, the pelvic girdle here. As you can see, it's a very flared pelvic girdle. Comes right out here because the bones of the femur come into the hip socket quite widely. They have very separated feet. Chimps and orangutans will have their feet apart, therefore they have a flared pelvic girdle, whereas the pelvic girdle of a human being is in a very different way. It's actually not flared as indicated with the chimps. So when we look at the bones of the famous so-called half-person, half-ape, commonly called Lucy, it's a set of female bones found in Ethiopia. I actually visited Ethiopia in February, and although they didn't have the original bones in that museum, they had a display which they were very proud of, saying, you know, our original ancestors came from not far away from Addis Ababa. And 3.18 million years ago, so-called. Johansson, of course, is famous as being the finder of these bones, and he maintains that these are the bones of an ape-like creature, yes, but changing into a human being, so it's half ape, half human. And he argues on the basis of the pelvic girdle, and he also argues on the basis of a knee joint, which I will come to. It was immediately obvious to me when I actually saw the reconstructed bones in the glass case, the original bones I think are in America, that the arms were exceedingly long, and it immediately spoke to me, ape. Because that is one thing that you notice about apes and orangutans and chimps and monkeys, that they tend to have very long arms compared with their overall length of body. Not like us, who tend to have arms which are relatively shorter. And it struck me, it's not very clear in that photograph, But in the reconstruction opposite here, it is actually quite evident that the arms were very, very long. Also, the little bones that they did have of the hands were indicating that the hands were big as well. The reconstruction of the bones from Lucy, certainly in terms of height of the pelvic girdle, might have suggested it was human. But the thing which is a giveaway that it's more chimp-like is the flared pelvic girdle, the flared hip joint. And this was admitted by these guys who wrote shortly after the finding of Lucy. By the way, it's called Lucy because a certain Beatles song was being played at the time, which is why they call it Lucy. The fact that the anterior portion of the iliac blade faces laterally in humans, but not in chimpanzees, is obvious. The marked resemblance of Lucy to the chimpanzee is equally obvious. This suggests to us that the mechanism of lateral pelvic balance during bipedalism was closer to that in apes than in humans. Now, this chap is not admitting in any way that he denies evolution. He's actually saying the opposite. But he is admitting that Lucy is much more chimp-like than human. So then he's saying, well, it was beginning to walk vertically, so that shows to us that actually bipedalism, that means to walk on two legs, was happening much earlier in apes than we realized. Okay? So he's not trying to say that he's denying evolution, but he is actually accepting that the hip joint, the iliac blade, is looking much more chimp-like than looking human-like. Now we come to the knee joint. Now, we need to realize an important point. Because the chimp has this flared pelvic girdle and he separates his legs, right? So you imagine the flared pelvic girdle here and the feet, which I can't do because obviously I'm coming out at an angle. But his legs go straight down, okay? And when you look at the knee, the femur is not coming in at an angle, it's actually coming virtually almost vertically down and straight and carries on with the same angle at the tibia. Whereas when we look at a human being, the angle that the femur comes in at an angle to the knee and the tibia comes out at a different angle. So there is a bit of an angle at the knee. And that is a giveaway if you can find the knee joint. You can then say, ah, this must be human or this must be chimp. Interestingly, Johansson, who discovered the skeleton of Lucy, said in a BBC program just recently, and said originally as well, oh, I found a knee joint. And the BBC reported it at the time, and they dwelt on this point in a program that they did recently about Lucy, about 2 or 3 months ago. In neither case was it stressed a very important point. Yes, a knee joint was found that looked a little bit human-like. But what they didn't tell you is that the actual bit of knee joint was not found at the same location where Lucy was found. It was found between 1 and 2 kilometers away. So there was no reason to connect that human-like knee joint with the skeleton of Lucy. And this is what I'm afraid you will find in the media, that they do not tell you important detail. And the BBC was most guilty not to bring that point out in their review just a few months ago. Now, it is true that the knee joint is very similar to a human knee joint, but not entirely. The human knee joint has the capacity to lock, so that when you actually stand vertically, you can actually feel your knee coming into a click. Sometimes people's knees actually do click, but most of us, we can at least feel that it's come into place and you're at rest. You could stand vertically, you could stand to attention. But an ape can't do that, or a chimp, or a monkey, or an orangutan. If they try and do that, they'll become unstable. They cannot lock their knee joints. which is why they tend to go around like this, which we can't do it, we can mimic it, but we can't really do it properly. I want you to feel this yourself. You stand up now, I said you'd be involved, and I want you to feel your knee joint just sort of clicking into place, right? That's what I'm referring to. Now, an ape can't do that, right? Some of you are finding it a little bit difficult, so I'll have you sit down again. But you've got the point. An ape can't do that. It can't stand to attention and say, aye, aye, sir, like that. It can't do that sort of motion. It's not designed to do it. It doesn't have that lockable knee joint. And just to put some further science into this such that you can see, and you can look up these papers if you want, if you're taking some notes, this was in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, 2007, a chap called Sokol was looking at the comparison of the walking mechanics in chimps and humans, right? There is no doubt that, of course, chimps, you see them in zoos, and orangutans and monkeys, of course they can walk vertically. You've seen it. We're not doubting that. We're not blind to the evidence that you can actually see these creatures running along the ground, walking on two legs. Nobody's doubting that. But the issue is, were chimps or some chimp-like creature gradually evolving into some human-like creature? And I'm going to show you no, there's no evidence of that, because chimps walk in a very different way to humans, and that's what Sokol brings out here. Just look at the last two pictures and you'll see something, see a chimp, you can see in that picture, is doing one step, right? And we're looking at the what's called the torque, I'll explain what that is in a moment, as a chimp does that one step, right? He's got not a vertical posture, he's leaning over, right? So there is motion at the hip, there is motion at the knee, and there is motion at the ankle. So when he does this step, this paper is addressing what are the forces involved? Well, it's not quite the forces. What is the work done? What is the energy used? You've heard of torque, some of you, right? If you're trying to undo something, you're putting torque, force times distance, the amount of energy to undo that bolt, all right? Well, you've got exactly the same when you have a joint in the human body or the joint in the ape body where there is some motion. How much energy is being used? That's what we're looking at. And you can see here a plot as to the amount of energy used in the hip. Then you've got the amount of work done in the ankle. Then you've got the amount of work done in the knee, right? Notice that when you compare that with the human being on the right, it's pretty different. First of all, notice that the amount of work done is much more in the hip for a creature which is trying to walk in like a chimp is doing, right? Most of the work is being done at the hip, right? Quite a lot of work is also being done at the ankle and the knee, but notice when you compare the knee to the knee of a human being, it's a totally different what we call phase. It is working one way in the beginning of the step in the chimp, and it's working the opposite way in a similar step of a human being doing that. Because what's happening is that the knee is straight out, if we're going to do a straight step, okay, it's doing that, and then there is a little bit of movement. Whereas for the creature like a chimp, he's doing that, and he hasn't got a straight out knee, which is why it's a totally different phase. So the motion of the knee is different. That's the difference of phase. In other words, I'm talking about the dip here and then a rise. And with the human being, it's a rise and a dip. And then lastly, please notice that whereas the chimp had most of the work being done at the hip, where is most of the work done for a human being? Down here at the foot. And it's hardly surprising, because in a moment I'm going to talk to you about the uniqueness of the human foot. The foot is remarkable. I took a picture once of monkeys, this is monkeys, not chimps, but The same applies to chimps. This was in Bali, in Indonesia. And I took here a picture of the hand and a picture of the foot of the monkey. And there basically is no difference in principle. A monkey or a chimp or an orangutan, all the simian kind, have basically four hands. They don't have feet, not the way we would talk about feet. They have four hands, hardly surprising, because they grab everything, you know that full well. Wonderful climbers, they can go over everything so easily. They're meant for what they do, and they do it very well. And they even have their tail as well, as a fifth sort of hand. So when you compare that with the human foot, there is no comparison, because the human foot is built for something very different. When you saw last year, the Asians in particular were very good at this, but some of the Europeans also, when they jumped in the Olympics onto those bars, do you remember seeing that? When they were dancing on these, sometimes it was a single bar, sometimes it was two bars, but it was particularly dramatic when you saw them doing a somersault, right, and then landing on the bar, here I am sort of thing, and then doing a somersault on the bar. How did they do it? Well, they were balancing on their feet. The foot is remarkable, and I'm going to get you involved in a moment again. You mustn't go to sleep. The foot is absolutely exquisitely designed for vertical stability. How do you get stability? You've got to have three points of contact to get stability. If you have two, you're unstable, but if you have a third, you're stable. Well, sort of. You do have stability, particularly if you're an agile 25-year-old or even younger. You can balance on one foot. And the reason is because you've got something at the back, which is the heel, of course, but then you've got two points of contact, not just one, at the front. You've got the ball of the foot just behind the big toe, and then you've got just behind the little toe, another little pad, as it were. So you've got the pad just behind the little toe, you've got the pad just behind the big toe, and you've got the heel, and that gives you stability. Try it out, as I'm doing now. Try that motion, all right? If you can't do it, I accept it, but come on, the young people can do it. If I can do it, anybody under my age, I won't tell you what it is, can do it as well, okay? So now you can feel yourself balancing, not just back to front, but also sideways, because you've got this tripod motion between the ball of the foot and the heel and also the little toe. So you see, that's what I'm referring to. There is stability ingrained in the way that the human foot is made. And it's also got a spring to it, because connected to those three points are ligaments. And the ligament that I'm referring to, going from back to front, is this one. It's split into two because of those two points of contact. So there is a spring, right? So that when you land, a person who's really trained in running knows this, he lands on the front two pads, not on his heel, right? He lands on the ball of his foot, and the foot comes down, the ligament expands, then there is a spring in it, and it springs him back up again. So he doesn't need these Nike shoes. He can do it with the human foot itself. And people who are in Africa, people in Asia who go around barefoot actually know that. If they train their feet well and get them well used to it, they can run for miles using the spring of the foot. They can keep going. And many people actually think that we've lost a lot by sometimes the shoes that we wear, and perhaps we have. That's another issue. But there are three points of contact with this spring. But the spring doesn't just lie between back and front. The spring also lies across here. So I haven't shown it here, but there is another arched muscle. I think it's on the next picture. Here we are. There is a transverse arch going across between the ball of the foot and the pad just behind the little toe. So you've got three arches, all which are spring-loaded. That is brilliant. And that is evidence of design. We are built for vertical posture. Interestingly, a bit further south from Ethiopia in Tanzania, there were some footprints which Mary Leakey found in 1978, and they dated these even older than Lucy. I don't accept the dates for a moment, but I can't deal with every issue in each talk. Radioactive dating and geological fossils and everything I've touched on when I talked about the books, and if you really want good books on that, Thousands Not Billions deals with radioactive dating very well indeed. So I think these are not millions of years old. But even if they were, you've got a big problem here. Because those footprints are very interesting because they look very human-like. And somebody looked at these recently in 2011 in the Journal of Royal Society Interface, no less, which is a very prestigious journal. And this is what he said. Crompton, Pataki and Savage et al. Said this. We found, however, that the Laetoli footprints represented a type of bipedal walking that was fully upright. Remember I compared the two types of walking? And it's that what they were looking at. And they were seeing that the way that these people or ape-like creatures were walking was like this, not like this, right? That's what he's referring to here. Represented a type of bipedal walking that was fully upright and driven by the front of the foot, particularly the big toe, much like humans today, and quite different to bipedal walking of chimpanzees and other apes. Well, what does that imply? If we join the dots of their own writings, what is it saying? These footprints weren't just human-like, they were human, which means that humans were existing 3.6 million years ago, not that I accept the dates, but way before the supposed age when ape-like creatures were developing into humans. In other words, their own data actually cuts the ground from underneath them. So that's a very interesting point. Now we're going to look at a different issue, which is the mammalian ear, the ear in mammals, right? So this doesn't just apply to humans. This now, from this bit on, applies to all mammals as against reptiles. Evolution says that reptiles changed eventually into mammals. They have a big problem. Where did the ear come from? We're now getting into intricacy. And I love the intricacy because it's in the detail that the science shows that evolution hasn't got a hope. It doesn't even get started, as we shall see. I'm particularly looking at the human ear, but what I'm saying is could apply to dogs. It could apply to apes, right? Could apply to any mammals, mouse as well. The hearing ear and the seeing eye, it says in the scripture, the Lord has made even both of them. So we're looking at the human ear, but remember, this applies to all mammals. Now, of course, you've got this outer ear here, which we could actually talk about, is not just a useless appendage. It's actually very important for drawing in the sound. It also helps us to sense distance because we have two ears, and the way we hear is affected by the shape here, which enables us to get us some idea as to where the sound is coming from. Then you have the ear canal, and coming up beyond the ear canal is the eardrum of the middle ear. The eardrum is a wonderful device because the drum is just that. It's a stretched skin, which, of course, can be pierced, and you have dangers of losing hearing because of that. But behind that vibrating skin are three bones, one of which, the hammer, is connected to this vibrating skin. The vibrations are not just a few cycles per second. When you are born, you can hear up to 20,000 cycles per second. So the human ear can hear vibrations going on at 20,000 per second. Very, very high notes, in other words. A dog ear can hear even further up, which is why, of course, we know that dogs are extremely good, and you have for searching for creatures, and you can communicate with them with a dog whistle, which is very, very high frequency. Did we call that stretched membrane, that stretched drum, as it were, the tympanic membrane? And you've got sound waves in air, right, which are vibrations in air like this, which are hitting this drum, which is vibrating, which then connects with these bones behind. Now we're going to look at those bones. Those bones are called the ossicle bones. I've mentioned the hammer, which is the first bone, which is technical term is the malleus. And behind it is another bone called the incus. And that bone is a dampener bone. It just dampens that vibration because the vibration's too much for what we're now going to do with that vibration. So it just dampens it slightly. And then it connects it to a third bone, which is called a stirrup, or the technical term is the stapes, but it looks like the stirrup you get onto a horse, right? That's why it's called that. And that stirrup is going in and out on what's called the oval window, which connects now to a completely different movement. What movement is that? Just before we come to that movement, let me just note that these three bones never grow. When you were born as a baby, those three little bones are exactly the same size as when, sadly, you die at the age 90 or whatever it is. Those bones never grow, and yet they're made of just bone material, just like all other bones. But everything is made such that they never grow. If they did, your ears would be this big, wouldn't they? By the time you grow, they grew at the same rate as all the other bones. Now we come to this inner ear, which is called the cochlea. Now the cochlea is an amazing device in its own right, because this one is full of liquid. Now, liquid has a property such that when you try and squeeze it, it won't squeeze. Air will squeeze. We call it, the technical term is compressible, right? The air goes in and out. If you get a bicycle pump, fill it with air, obviously, because the air's all around you. Put your finger over the end, then push in. You can push in quite extensively, right? So the air will compress. If you now fill it with water, put the end on the water, pull in, you get the water. If you now put your finger over the end, you can't squeeze it. Essentially, liquid or any fluid like that is incompressible. So we're going from compressible air, where the sound is coming in, vibrating these bones mechanically. Now we're going to connect to liquid, which is incompressible. This is an amazing feature. Now look at these videos to get an idea as to what's going on. Here's the hammer, here's the incus dampener bone, here's the stapes in the oval window, and it's vibrating liquid which is sloshing around in the inner ear, right? We still haven't got to anywhere near the end of hearing. We're just in this process of transmitting what is essentially movement of air into mechanical energy, into now movement of liquid, mechanical but with liquid. Well, this is just staggering, because if you think about that point about liquid being incompressible, what are you going to do with the excess of liquid? Because it's got to go somewhere. Well, the great designer, the Lord himself, didn't leave this cochlea without a way of dealing with that. He actually made sure that there was a round window which has got a little membrane which relieves the pressure when the stirrup pushes on the oval window. So they go, as you could see, one was bulging out while the other one bulged in. So the liquid has somewhere to go because it won't compress. So if I just play that again, you can see it, hopefully. You can see here that this is the window relieving the pressure here. Now, what about this liquid motion in here? Well, we need now to unpack that cochlea. So we're going to unravel that cochlea, as it were, and we find that there is a membrane inside the cochlea which is vibrating with the vibration of the liquid. And that is called the basilar membrane. And it's a bit like an xylophone, as you can see here in the middle picture. Here's the what looks like an xylophone. Now I'm going to play you a little video to explain what goes on.
Okay, now uncoils and look at the basal membrane, and now see what happens when we play individual tones. Now a chord. And finally, something really complex.
It's evident that our inner ear is built for receiving not just one vibration, but many vibrations altogether. Indeed, if we try to bypass this cochlea, which you can do, you can have cochlear implants, right, where you, a person who's lost the capacity to hear can hear again by having little electrical signals being sent directly to the brain, but it will never be as good as the human ear, particularly when it comes to music, right? We're designed to listen to a number of frequencies together, and so we get harmonics, we get beautiful sounds, we get ugly sounds as well, of course, particularly if you go and really hear something very, very loud deliberately, and some young people sadly lose their hearing because of that. You need to be very careful looking after your ear. It's a very delicate instrument. But it's designed to listen to not just one note, but to listen to modulated notes. So we can recognize a voice, not because of one harmonic, but because of all the other harmonics. Everybody is unique in terms of their voice. Have you thought of that? I'm using, without realizing it, many, many frequencies as I speak. I'm not just using one. So just look at this. This now demonstrates the wonderful complication and the sophistication of this stirrup vibrating against the oval window with the circular window shown at bottom left. And then, although you haven't got the basilar membrane in there specifically, but it's the basilar membrane which is vibrating, which is exciting different frequencies depending which frequency is going in, and there is liquid movement. Well, we still haven't got to the electrical bit. How do we get to the electrical signal? Remember, we go right up to 20,000 hertz. Well, as that basilar membrane vibrates, it's got tiny little hairs connected to it. And as the liquid sloshes over the basilar membrane and causes the basilar membrane to move, there are tiny little hairs called cilia, which, when they move in one direction, creates a chemical reaction which involves electrochemical charges called ions, I-O-N-S, right? Not I-R-O-N-S, okay? Ions, that means charged particles are created. Electrochemical processes are going on. So we started with mechanical motion in air, translated to mechanical motion with bones, translated to mechanical sloshing motion of liquid, translated to mechanical motion of basilar membrane, to now another mechanical motion of hairs, which is now translated to chemical processes, which is now beginning to translate to electrical energy, okay? So as these hairs move over, you can see that there is calcium positive ions and phosphorus positive ions created, and equally well, as a consequence, electrons are actually sent down the hairs. Such sophistication and exquisite energy balances is telling you this is designed. In fact, no engineer could mimic the mammalian ear. It's so exquisitely made. This little video just goes further to demonstrate this. You can see the little hairs moving over as the basilar membrane pushes them over. And every time they move over, there is an electrical signal then sent through the nerves, eventually leading to the brain. I haven't time, but there is also another little organ which we should mention called the organ of Cortis, which is involved in actually enabling that electrical current to go to the brain. I'm going to leave it there, but to be frank, you don't really need another argument. The evidence just put on the table says to everybody, here guys, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. But I will go a bit further, and that is, I will deal with my last point. Just before I get there, let me just notice something. Those who oppose us say, okay, we can see there's really quite an issue here. Even my friend from Oxford does admit that. Perhaps I shouldn't call him my friend, but he does say, my colleague, the reptilian lower jaw is more complicated. Hereby hangs a fascinating tale that I reluctantly omitted from this book. This was his book, The Greatest Show on Earth, published in 2009. Then he says, in an amazing feat of evolutionary legerdemain, I'll come to what that word means in a moment, the smaller bones of the reptilian jaw were co-opted into the mammalian ear, where they constitute an exquisitely delicate bridge, that bit's correct, to transport sound from the eardrum to the inner ear. I couldn't have said it better for that last sentence. But he talks about evolutionary legerdemain. Well, if you look up at Roger's thesaurus or any thesaurus, you'll know that the word, the English word legerdemain means, does anybody know what it means? Sleight of hand, trickery. Or you could really insert the word magic. Or some thesauruses use the word hocus pocus. Interestingly, Brian Cox did a little snippet on the evolution, he thought, of the ear in mammals. And this is what he said.
Around 210 million years ago, the first mammals evolved. And unlike our friends the reptiles here, mammals have a jaw that's made of only one bone. A reptile's jaw is made of several bones fused together. So that freed up two bones, which moved and shrank and eventually became the malleus, the incus, and stapes. So this is the origin of those three tiny bones that are so important to mammalian hearing.
I know he's a fellow of the Institute of Physics, which I am as well, but I don't think flick books prove anything, do you? Let me come to my last point. Mind. Mind. Where does it come from? And where does information come from? The cell has an amazing feature in the nucleus, and it's called the double helix DNA, the deoxyribosic nucleic acid, across which are wonderful triplets of chemicals called bases or nucleotides, which the order of is vital. Not the actual chemical composition of them is so vital, but the order of them. Yes, the chemical composition is necessary, but it's the order and the coding which is involved in those triplets of nucleotides which is all important. Francis Crick and James Watson discovered this in 1953. When they discovered it, it was a bombshell. Because suddenly it was grasped that there was effectively software written in the nucleus of every living system, plants included, such that coded information was stored in tiny little molecules, which are very, very long indeed in when it comes to DNA and the proteins for which they code. And since then, wonderful computer simulations have been produced which show the amazing complexity of the cell which illustrates signal processing is going on. It would take a whole lecture to unfold all the detail here, but the essence of it is that the order of three chemicals, there are four of them in all, guanine, adenine, thymine, and cytosine, right? So G, A, C, and T. And G always combines with C on the other side, and T always combines with the non-coding strand of DNA on the other side with A, okay? And so you've got all these GCs and ATs, sometimes this way around, sometimes that way around. And so on the coding part of DNA, that is the one strand of it, you've got either GGA or GAT or CAT or CTT, and you've got a whole string of these triplets, right? And these triplets, one particular one, will code for a particular amino acid. And it's not the chemistry which is saying to the ribosome, which is another molecular machine I haven't got time to tell you about, but this ribosome comes up and it actually literally reads the order of these triplets and it says, that means that I need a particular amino acid. And that amino acid is drawn alongside, and that amino acid then is slotted into place, and then it will see CTT, and that means get another amino acid, a different one, and latch that onto the first one. And then it carries on going, and it literally reads all the signal, and it says, right, I've now made a protein out of hundreds, if not thousands, of amino acids. That's what's going on at an enormous rate, like 500 times a second. This is going on in every single cell of every living thing. Where did that all come from? It basically means this, that we're not just made of matter and energy, we're made of information. We have an information system, which means that something's put it there. Can matter and energy make information? You're dealing here with coded instructions. Do coded instructions arise from the matter that they're sitting on? Does a hardware computer like this falling to bits Dell laptop make its own software? No, it doesn't. You actually need software to drive the hardware. Software is not matter or energy. What is it? Well, it exists, but what is it? It's like language. What is it? We know it exists. It's very important. We're using it now. What does information and what does language really indicate? It indicates that something is there which is non-material. Where does mathematics come from? Where does logic come from? Because that's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with systems logic. Where does systems logic come from? Are we saying that the matter and the energy somehow made its own logic circuitry? That would be nonsense to a computer software engineer. He would say immediately, no. I may not do it very well, but you need me to make the software, to make the computer program, to actually drive all this system to make it work. Well, why don't we say the same about DNA? Oh, we can't go there. That has implications, big philosophical implications. Batten down the hatches. No non-material causes here. No. Matter and energy did it over billions of years. Did it? Do you really think that such a system with coded instructions came about of its own making? No, that is nonsense. Which brings us to the real Achilles heel. Actually, I had a drawing of the Achilles heel earlier. I didn't mention it, but that ligament which came from the heel up to the by the tibia. That Achilles heel in evolution is this subject, information. They can't say where it comes from, and they daren't admit that it's non-material. If they were to admit that a non-material entity existed, that would be the end of the argument, and they know it. But all the evidence is mounting that that is what actually is going on at the bottom of genetics. So when Francis Crick said, you, your joys, your sorrows, your memories, your ambitions, your sense of personal identity, free will, are in fact no more than a behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and associated molecules, pretty desperate ending to his research career, because he was basically saying, I'm no more than just a lump of neurons. In fact, Richard Dawkins said to a friend of mine last year, and this friend of mine is an open-air mission speaker, and he often gives out tracts in the High Street of Oxford, and it just so happened that he just finished doing an open-air meeting, and he met Richard Dawkins just coming by with his bike. He talked with him, and he had the courtesy, and I thank him for this, or I'm sure he thanked him for it, you know, to stop and talk for a while. Conversation got a little bit heated and strained, and so much so at one point Richard Dawkins expressed in exasperation, "My brain is just a lump of meat." Now, he is forced by his presupposition to say that, but if I am just a lump of meat with neurons, what does that say about my own mind and who I am? Is that all I am? You see, code and language sits on material, as I said. But also, the message is not defined by the code or the language. I'm using English. We could translate into Welsh. I've never had that done, but I'm sure it could be done, and the Welsh would probably find all sorts of lovely words, you know, in that beautiful Celtic language to express the same ideas, right? But I hope it would be translated so well that you'd say, well, I can understand it if you say it in English or in Welsh. The message is not defined by what language you're using. Just like the language or the code is not defined by the matter. You understand the point? So there are massive levels of information when you look at information carefully. Information isn't matter or energy. And if you don't mind, I'm going to skip that. And I'm going to skip that. So where does information lie in the DNA? You see, the materialist is bound to say, well, it's somehow arisen out of, you can see a number of things I've put up there, the DNA polymerase, which is a protein which DNA codes for, and yet the DNA polymerase makes DNA. So we've got a real chicken and egg situation there. But where does the information lie? They might say, well, it somehow lies in that protein which makes DNA. They actually won't find the answer that way. None of these will give you the answer. Because really, the information lies in the arrangement, encoded instructions. And if you've got coded instructions, basically computer programming, it's telling you that some mind put it there. It even applies, by the way, to Windows 7, believe it or not. Do you know, there really is a Bill Gates who was addressing people in London just today, actually. And Bill Gates actually, and his merry men in Washington State, actually did build the software, believe it or not. I know it's a bit cumbersome, but it does work after a fashion. And it implies that there is a mind behind it. And that's, of course, what the evolutionist cannot accept. Haldane realized this point. He was no Christian. He died before the war, but he said, if my mental processes are determined solely by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true. And hence, I have no reason for supposing that my brain is just composed of atoms. In other words, thinking logically and thinking processes must be somehow different to the very instrument that I'm using, which is my brain. In order for me to think, I have to use my brain, but my brain is just an instrument. It's not where the thoughts really originate from. That's the point. Logic and argument must be transcendent, Haldane is saying, to the instrument that I'm using, which is neurons. Have you got it? This is a very important philosophical point. Chesterton, he was a Catholic thinker, but a very clever man in his day, said this: materialism has a sort of insane simplicity. It has just the quality of a madman's argument. It has the idea of covering everything and the sense of leaving it out. Contemplate some able and sincere materialist, you'll have exactly this unique sensation. He understands everything and everything doesn't seem worth understanding. His cosmos may be complete in every rivet and cogwheel, but his cosmos is smaller than our world. He hit it bang on there. You can look at the effect of thinking, you can look at the effect of mind, but you cannot reduce mind and logic to chemistry and physics. You've got to stand back from it. There is something bigger here going on. If I showed you that picture, or even if I showed you that picture, you might say that's just a lot of splodges on a green background. You might look at all the colours. You might even look at the pigment of the red on the original and the green and say, oh, I can analyse it all. But have you understood it? No. You need to stand back a bit further. Ah, Monet, poppy field, beautiful impressionist painting. I love the impressionists. And suddenly you realise, yes, I could analyse all the pigment, but I hadn't grasped what the picture was really saying of the beauty of a summer's day in France. Reductionism, which is what I was describing earlier, misses the big picture. He understands everything, but everything doesn't seem worth understanding. He's missed the point, in other words. Naturalism cuts off the very branch on which the naturalist is thinking and basing his very thought processes. In order for him to make these statements, oh, there is no God! He's using a brain which he was given, and all the evidence says was given by a mind much greater than him, right? Everything is pointing to the fact that there is transcendent mind which enables him to think and use the very instrument and come out with these statements that God is not there. He's cutting off the very branch on which he's thinking, on which he's sitting. Rationality, as I showed you, and I could quote you, other philosophers know this argument full well. Rationality has no meaning if you reduce everything to just neurons flying around. Naturalism underlines the very basis for naturalism, because he's lost the absolute, which is transcendency. There is a transcendent God much bigger than us. Particles and molecules don't think. I actually used this argument against an evolutionary psychologist recently. You can look it up on the web if you want the email I can give it you, or the web address I can give it you. This is a very vital argument, and I think the evolutionary psychologist hadn't even thought of it. I find that most evolutionists have not thought and haven't grasped where their reasoning is going. It's not that hard to actually bring a person to see that there is a very powerful argument that they are missing if they're open to it. The problem is most people won't even go there. Faraday said our philosophy in his day, you use that like we would use our science, whilst it shows us these things, and he was talking about electromagnetism, which led to the wonderful inventions we have today, including computers, which are built on those principles, should lead us to think of him who hath wrought or made them, we would say today, for it is said by an authority, far above that which even these works present, that. And he was speaking in front of a packed audience in the Royal Institution. Often there was the Prince Consort, Prince Albert, sometimes even Queen Victoria, and all the noble people of London. You can imagine Faraday quietly saying that there is something far greater. The invisible things of God are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. If we do our science properly, it points incontrovertibly to the fact there is a God, he has made us, and no one has any excuse to say that God is not there. It is impossible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Impossible. Atheism is dishonest with the data.